thank the organizers for the chance to speak here. It's a lot colder than Seattle, but at least there's some sunshine. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about today is some recent joint work with Herbert Koch and Daniel Totaru on obtaining LP bounds on eigenfunctions, or generally spectrally localized functions, for Dirichlet forms with rough coefficients. Okay, and today I'm going to stick to the two-dimensional case because that's the case where our most recent results are. Okay, so the starting point for this talk is that we'll be working with a Dirichlet form on a compact manifold. And so we can write our eigenfunction equation as div A grad phi. I'll write it in this form, div A of x grad phi plus lambda squared rho of x phi equals 0. And here A is going to be a real positive definite matrix. Rho is going to be a real positive function. This is a second order eigenfunction equation. And the way we've normalized the eigenvalues are in terms of, we'll write the eigenvalues as lambda squared. So here lambda is to be thought of as the frequency associated to the eigenfunction. Okay. Now, if you want, you could, of course, put the rho of x inverse over here and make it in Laplace-Beltrami form. But when you're dealing with rough coefficients, it's better to pose it as a Dirichlet form because here this is well-defined, even when your coefficients are merely L infinity. Okay, so in the case, then, that you have even measurable coefficients that are non-degenerate, then by Rolle's lemma, there exists a complete, and we're on a compact manifold, there exists a complete orthonormal basis for L2. I call it phi lambda j, where the frequencies lambda j head off to infinity. And the question that we're interested in is studying the LP norm of the phi lambda j's in terms of lambda for large lambda. All right. Now, obtain, yep. Every strictly real, self-adjoint, second order, yeah. Okay. Okay. So, getting sharp bounds on individual eigenfunctions is actually a very much deeper question than the one we study. That depends upon the global geometry, the behavior of the global geodesic flow. All the techniques we're going to use only involve geometry on unit scale, which means we, by the uncertainty principle, we can't get any finer localization in frequency than unit localization in frequency. So actually, rather than studying individual eigenfunctions, we study what we'll call a spectral cluster at frequency lambda. And this is a function which is a combination of eigenfunctions where you have a frequency spread of width 1 about the central frequency lambda. Okay, so they're spectrally localized within a frequency spread of 1. Which is maximal to, say, localizing them in space to size 1. So then the question that we're interested in can be thought of as obtaining ratios on the LP bound of F to the L2 bound of F over the manifold in terms of some power of the frequency lambda, depending on P, and we're interested in the case, of course, P bigger than or equal to 2. Okay, so this can be, these bounds can be thought of as giving quantitative bounds on just how concentrated or how peaked, how localized an eigenfunction can be as the frequency increases. And clearly, the larger the frequency, you can get more and more highly localized eigenfunctions, so there will be a growth, and we want to get the try to get the best possible values for gamma of P depending upon the regularity of the coefficients. Okay, well, to first look at the smooth case to get the background, we'll note that there are actually two important examples that dictate, in the smooth case, what the correct value of gamma is. And both of these examples can be realized as actual eigenfunctions on the sphere in two dimensions. So it's a very special case where they can be realized as eigenfunctions. But you can do things like this as spectral clusters on, in fact, any manifold. And say, so the two examples So we'll look at this two-sphere in R3 with the usual metric. So the first example to consider are just the highest weight eigenfunctions on this sphere. And so these actually live, are very highly concentrated along some great circle. Okay, so precisely, you have an eigenfunction at frequency lambda that lives within a little tube of diameter lambda to the minus 1/2 about any great circle. These are the highest weights. And as we'll actually see, these examples occupy the smallest volume among all spectral clusters at a given frequency. Then the other example, which exhibits the interesting behavior for large values of P, are what are called the zonal examples, or zonal eigenfunctions. So these are not highly localized, but they are highly peaked. So these have they're peaked at, say, a particular point, for example, the North Pole. Their energy is more or less spread over the entire sphere, but they have a weak decay as you move away from the North Pole. They decay like lambda to the 1/2 times 1 plus, I believe it's lambda cos phi to the minus 1/2. Where phi is the angle, spherical coordinates. Okay. And so these examples here, highly concentrated at a point, will turn out to have the highest peak value, so they will actually saturate the L infinity norm. All right, now, one thing to keep in mind when you're looking at eigenfunctions, talking about eigenfunctions, is the fact that eigenfunctions correspond to periodic solutions of the wave equation. Okay, so you can alternatively think of these as periodic solutions of the wave equation. On the other hand, solutions to the wave equation, when you solve the wave equation, the energy flows along the geodesic flow. If you have energy at a certain point, time t later, that energy will have flowed along the geodesic flow, distance t. And so, therefore, since these are stable under the wave equation, essentially you want to think that any eigenfunction, the support of the eigenfunction, must be invariant under the geodesic flow. And so, roughly speaking, the energy support of an eigenfunction must be a bundle, a union of geodesics. Okay. So thinking in that way, this example here, the first example, corresponds to a collection of all geodesics, within distance and angle lambda to the minus 1/2 around the great circle. Okay, so that consists of a all geodesics, essentially passing through a point with an angular spread of theta equals lambda minus 1/2. And it's not hard to see that this is actually the smallest angular spread that you can have, which is consistent with energy flow and the uncertainty principle. And so to see that, let's imagine that you take a little piece of that eigenfunction and take the Fourier transform. So look at f hat. Then imagine that the Fourier transform has an angular spread of size theta. Well, since it is sitting out at frequency lambda, its Fourier transform is going to be here, distance lambda away from the origin, which means that the frequency spread will be of size lambda theta. Okay. On the other hand, geodesics that leave, that are angle theta apart, time 1 later, as you get halfway around the circle, their spatial spread will be of size theta. And so the uncertainty principle says that delta x, delta c, that is lambda theta squared, must be bigger than 1, and this gives you a lower bound for how concentrated a bundle of invariant geodesics can be under the wave equation. Okay, the second example, by the way, is you can think of it as union of all highest weight eigenfunctions that pass through the North Pole. So it's actually like a radial eigenfunction. So the energy of the second one is spread out evenly over all directions. All right, so these two examples together we'll give you lower bounds for the exponent gamma of p there, and so we can plot these. So for the first example, if you look at the ratio of the LP to L2 norm, well, this function is essentially a bump function localized to a set of volume lambda to the minus 1/2, and so the ratio of the LP to L2 norm will be lambda to the 1/2 times 1/2 minus 1 over p. Second example, you can just explicitly calculate it, compare it to the L2 norm, the ratio of the LP norm to the L2 norm. Will essentially be lambda to the 2 times 1/2 minus 1 over p minus 1/2. And so together these give you lower bounds for that exponent gamma of p, and to draw a little picture here, so when p is, well, we'll draw gamma of p versus 1 over p, when p is infinity, the exponent is 1/2, when p is 2, of course, the L2 to L2 norm is 1, and then these two examples, the behavior meets up here at p equals 6, where the exponent is 1/6, and so this is the picture, so these are the highest weight, and this is the zonal examples for large values of p that dictate the behavior. Okay. So this is the best you can do on any manifold, and in fact it was shown by Sog in roughly 1988, I guess, that these estimates do hold on any compact manifold without boundary with smooth coefficients. Okay, so this picture is sharp. So these examples, in fact, do give you the correct behavior. At least in the case where the coefficients are smooth and M has no boundary. Okay. Now, of course, the case p equals 2 is trivial. The case p equals infinity is related to the spectral sharp special asymptotic counting estimates of Hormander, Levitan, and Novakumovich. So the real estimate of interest is the L6 estimate. And everything else follows by interpolation. Okay, so this raises the question then, what are the correct bounds if your coefficients are not smooth or if your manifold actually has a boundary to it? Okay. And in each case, it turns out that for certain examples, you can violate these estimates. So in the case of a boundary with certain kinds of boundary, or in the case of coefficients which are sufficiently rough. So this was first observed, I believe, in the thesis of Greiser in 1990. This is Daniel Greiser's thesis. He observed that the estimates of SOG, actually fail if you work on the unit disk with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So just work on the set, work with the equation delta squared f, delta f plus lambda squared f equals 0 on the set x less than or equal to 1. Put Dirichlet or Neumann conditions on the boundary. And the example are just, of course, a Bessel function. So classically, these are called the Rayleigh modes, Rayleigh whispering gallery modes. In terms of Bessel functions, you look at e to the I n theta, jn of c naught r, where c naught is the first zero of the nth Bessel function. And if you look at the asymptotics of the Bessel functions, these examples live within a lambda to the minus 2/3. So the frequency lambda will be essentially the n there. And these actually live within a neighborhood besides lambda to the minus 2/3 of the boundary of the circle. So they're more highly concentrated than the highest weight eigenfunctions. Now, if you want to think of this in terms of the geodesic flow picture, then this corresponds to a bunch of, you know, geodesics that are nearly tangent to the boundary, reflected geodesics that are nearly tangent to the boundary. And it turns out that this does not, in fact, violate the uncertainty principle. And you can see that because, well, it follows from the looking at the following picture. So if you take a reflected geodesic, say traveling at angle theta to the boundary, then you'll note that, well, just by the geometry, the maximum separation from the boundary is like theta squared. So in fact, you have a singular dispersion relation for geodesics that are nearly tangent to the boundary. Their physical separation is like theta squared instead of like theta in a manifold without boundary. And so for this example, the angular spread of the Rayleigh whispering modes are of size lambda minus 1/3, so the frequency spread is like lambda 2/3, and the physical spread is like lambda minus 2/3. Okay, so this, the failure, well, it satisfies the uncertainty principle. What goes wrong is the dispersion relation when you're moving nearly tangentially to a convex obstacle. Okay, so these examples give you different, they modify that picture on the disk. So let me, I want to save this next graph, so I'll plot it here. Okay. So if you plot the LP norm to L2 norm for this example, instead of a half times half minus 1 over P, you'll get 2/3 minus 1 over P. And so you're led to this picture on the disk. You still have the same zonal modes as you do on the sphere, only they'd be expressed in terms of radial Bessel functions. So the example here would be considered Jn of lambda r, well, times e to the in theta, I guess. Sorry, J naught of lambda r, where lambda is a zero, a binary function. It's highly peaked near the origin. And then here, the graph is going to be 2/3 1 half minus 1 over P, and the critical point now is going to be at L8, where there should be a loss of 1/4. Okay, so for the disk, the critical estimate is to prove lambda to the 1/4 estimate at L8. So this part of the picture is still the same. What's been modified is the small values of P, where the tubular examples are sharp. All right, so as an aside, my interest is going to be the regularity case, but as an aside, we actually proved in joint work with SOG a couple years ago that, in fact, these estimates do hold on any two-dimensional Riemannian manifold with boundary. So for Riemannian manifolds with boundary, this has been settled. Interestingly, the proof for the disk was not settled until the general case was settled. Anyway, so this holds for two-dimensional Riemannian manifolds with boundary. I should say smooth Riemannian manifolds although that can be dropped a little bit. Right. So that question is more or less settled. There's some, yeah. Oh, compact. You could also do localized versions of this. The proof can be localized. We use wave equation methods, but yeah. All right. Okay, so then the question is, what happens when A and rho are not smooth? And the starting point for this study was the observation that if you have a manifold with boundary, say a smooth manifold with boundary, you can think of that as a special case of a manifold without boundary but with Lipschitz coefficients. Okay. And the construction is quite easy. You just take your new manifold to be two copies of the manifold with boundaries sewn together along the boundary. Near the boundary, you work in normal geodesic coordinates on each copy and patch it together using those coordinates. In that case, the extension of the metric will just be the even extension of the metric. It'll be Lipschitz, smooth on each side, continuous up to the boundary, and Lipschitz as you move across the boundary. Okay, so for example, if you're working on the disk and working coordinates x2 equals 1 minus r and x1 equals theta, then your even metric would be d squared dx 2 squared plus essentially, well, if you take the first order Taylor expansion, it looks like 1 plus absolute x2 d squared dx 1 squared, I believe. Yeah. Okay. And so for this Lipschitz metric, having a singularity, this is an attractive singularity, and so basically, if you were to look at the geodesic flow for this metric, the reflected geodesics would correspond to geodesics near the x1 axis, and you'd have the exact same concentration that geodesics with an angular spread of lambda to the minus 1/3 actually did within a neighborhood of size lambda minus 2/3. So you get the same concentrated tube examples, neighborhoods of size lambda minus 2/3. Okay, so again, for Lipschitz metrics, this is the best that you can do in two dimensions. All right. Now, back in the 90s, in joint work with SOG, we generalized this example to show that for any S less than 2, you can construct a metric which has belongs to the class CS, for which SOG's estimates fail. Basically, you put an S up there, and you'll get tube examples which are still more highly concentrated than power 1/2. So, so for any S less than 2, SOG's estimates can fail. On the other hand, we proved that for C2 metrics, the estimates hold. So the real interesting case then for non-smooth metrics is the case looking at metrics with less than 2 derivatives in the holder setting and trying to get the sharp example. And today, for simplicity, I'll stick to Lipschitz metrics. Okay. So the question is, for Lipschitz metrics, how close can we get to this picture here? To establishing that. Ultimately, we'd like to show that is the correct, those are the correct bounds for any Lipschitz metric. We have it for the special case of ones which come from reflecting manifolds of boundary. And at the moment, we don't know how to construct any examples that are worse for Lipschitz metrics than they are, than the ones that come from reflecting manifolds with boundary. In particular, you cannot get a worse radial example. You cannot get a worse analog that, as far as we know, than the one that you'd get in the smooth case. All right, so that's the question I want to talk about today, how close we can get to that picture. And I guess the answer is somewhat close, though we can't quite get the whole thing. Okay, so the first step, in getting that picture was actually done around 2000, so we showed that you can, in fact, so those estimates hold, so the desired estimates hold, at least in the range p between 2 and 6, and p equals infinity. So we can get small values of p, and then we can get the largest value of p. This leaves a gap. Okay. And the proof consists of actually proving a slightly stronger bound. So the key idea or key estimate is that, in fact, you can prove the no-loss estimates. So you can prove SOG's no-loss bounds but only on small sets. And then you lose by having to add up over a bunch of small sets. And you'll get the correct bounds, at least for p equals 6, or between 2 and 6. Okay. And so the precise estimate we prove is that if you're working just on a cube of side length frequency to the minus a third, then you do get the same exponent as you would get for L6. For smooth metrics. Okay. Now here I put the energy norm. Basically the energy norm behaves like the L infinity L2 norm. You sort of think of this as this equation as being a wave equation in your function. And so this involves both the driving force and the energy of the function, but just need to know that this is bounded by the L2 norm of F over the whole manifold. So this will give you uniform bounds for the L6 norm over any small cube sitting inside your manifold. And the key idea behind this proof, so here the key step here, is that any Lipschitz metric, or any Lipschitz function A, is in fact well approximated on this small scale, lambda to the minus one-third, by a C2 function. Okay. So in other words, you can essentially replace, if you're just working on a very small scale, you can essentially replace your eigenfunction equation by one with C2 coefficients. Now, to make that a little more precise, what we're saying is that if you rescale, you take a Lipschitz function and rescale it by lambda to minus one-third to make its derivative very small, then you can find a C2 function depending on lambda so that in absolute value, they differ by 1 over lambda to the two-thirds. And the relevance here is that when you rescale, you know, your function up by a factor lambda to the minus one-third, you scale the frequency down by a factor lambda to the minus one-third, or lambda to the one-third. So this is, would actually be the frequency of your spectral cluster rescaled up. So put another way, if you take your spectral cluster and rescale it by a factor of frequency to the one-third, you will get essentially a spectral cluster for a C2 metric. The idea being that this error will be of one lower order and it can be treated as a driving force in the spectral cluster equation. Okay. So this is basically a spectral cluster for a C2 metric, so you can apply the C2 bounds on unit cubes and then scaling back get the no loss bounds on cubes of size lambda to the minus one-third. Okay. All right, so to see how this implies those estimates over the whole manifold, well, you just want to add up over small sets. And for that, you have to note that, you don't quite want to deal with cubes, you want to deal with slabs. But if you localize your spectral cluster in frequency space, say you just take all frequencies pointing in a say the x1 direction, then in fact you can prove no loss estimates over any slab of thickness lambda to minus one-third in the x1 direction. So for each of these sets, you have no loss bounds manifold, and then when you add up over the total, whether a total of lambda to the one-third sets, you have to add up over, and so you will lose a third times a sixth to get bounds over the entire manifold. Okay. And this is the correct power for L6, so it corresponds to the best possible power for Lipschitz metrics. Okay. Now, you can apply the exact same argument to larger values of p. So this argument will apply to all p bigger than 6, and what that would prove is the following bound. So this first step, just the no-loss estimates on scale, lambda minus 1/3, would give you this exponent. You'd get lambda to the, okay, well, this is the no-loss bound, but then when you add up, you'd get a loss of 1 over 3p in your exponent times your L2 metric. And so this is sharp for p equals 6, or p between 2 and 6, but for larger values of p, it's not sharp. And so that argument there would essentially give you, well, we have that picture, and then it would give the interpolation up there. So you do get the correct L infinity estimate, and you get the correct estimate between 2 and 6, but there's a lot of room for improvement between 6 and infinity, and that's the interest of our latest work. Okay. So looking at this proof, you might ask yourself, okay, how can this be improved? Well, the improvement is based on the following intuition. If you look at the method of proof, where you prove uniform bounds over small sets and then add up, well, that proof is sharp for p equals 6, because the counterexamples for p equals 6 are essentially periodic over slabs. So for p equals 6, remember the examples of interest were these tube examples concentrated in tubes of diameter lambda minus 2/3. A simple calculation shows that these tubes actually saturate the no-loss estimates on every single tube, and so when you add up, this estimate is actually sharp. Okay. On the other hand, when you're dealing with p bigger than 6, the examples that would saturate on a small scale would not be the tube examples, they'd be the zonal eigenfunction examples, and those have energy spread out over a large angle. And so the idea is that if you have such an example that is bad in one slab, then it has to be better in another slab because the energy must disperse and flow out. So improving upon this uniform summation result is going to require using energy flow arguments for Lipschitz metrics, particularly showing that there is some dispersion of energy. Okay. And so that's the recent work with Koch and Tataru. And the idea, or the key step in our proof, is to show that we actually can get, using energy flow arguments, for larger values of p, we can get no-loss estimates on larger scales. So for L6, the best possible no-loss estimates you can get are on cubes of size lambda minus 1/3. For larger values of p, we successively get no-loss estimates on larger cubes. And then that will give us better estimates when you add up over slabs. And so the proof that does that precisely is it's an inductive argument, and so this is the main theorem. So the idea is that we're going to start with no-loss estimates on one scale, and then use energy flow arguments to get no-loss estimates for larger values of p at larger scales. So we suppose that we have a no-loss estimate for some value of p, holding uniformly and so let's suppose that this holds uniformly for all cubes q of diameter say delta squared, then we can prove essentially a no-loss estimate for p plus 2 over cubes q bar, over cubes of diameter delta. Okay. So every time you increase p by 2, your no-loss regime is the square root of the previous scale on which you had no-loss estimates. Okay. Well, actually we get a log. There, we actually lose 2 powers of log lambda at each scale. So for large values of p, you'll get to keep successfully pick up essentially p values of log lambda. But ignoring log, the no-loss estimates increase every time p increases by 2. And so to see what this gives you for the global estimates, well, for p equals 6, your no-loss region was lambda minus a third, and so your best L6 estimate was lambda to the 1/6 plus a third times a sixth. That is sharp. For the next step is p equals 8. There your no-loss size is lambda minus a sixth, and so your L8 estimate will be, so the no-loss power is a fourth, you lose 1/48 relative to what you want to prove. So we don't quite get, so for L8, no, already for L8 we'd like to end up there. We actually get halfway there. Okay. And then every time you increase p by 2, your no-loss estimate goes down. So for p equals 10, your no-loss estimate is going to be 1 over 10 times 12, 1 over 120. Generally, the loss will be 1 over, the loss relative to what you'd like to prove is 1 over 3p times 1 over 2 to the p minus 6 over 2. So we get exponentially close to the desired bounds within the width of the chalk line as we go up to infinity. But for no power of p, do we actually get the sharp bounds? Okay. Let's say if we start at p equals 2. Oh, sorry, what is? Oh, yeah. Correct. So, right. Although then you'd get the wrong power. No, it, yeah, we do, you're right. It's starting to have to be p bigger than 6 because of, yeah, the summability arguments that we get. Although, I'm not quite sure whether you could actually use this argument to start with L4 and get L6. But I think it would require different arguments. Okay, so to try to wrap this up, let me sort of present what the key idea behind the energy flow is. So the way that we're going to capture the energy flow is actually by doing a decomposition of your spectral cluster F at every scale. So let's suppose you've got a fixed scale delta in that argument. So we've got a cube QR. Let's say this is side length delta. Then we show that if you take F, consider F on this cube, you can actually write F as a sum of terms F sub T, where T varies over tubes of diameter delta squared and length delta. Okay, and this decomposition will be a maximal, you know, disjoint decomposition of this cube into tubes, so they'll be separated by angle delta and spatially separated by delta squared. So I guess there's a total of delta inverse tubes of this form, and that decomposition respects the splitting of your cube into cubes of size delta squared. And so the idea is that the improved bound is going to come from using the no-loss estimates, the no-loss LP estimates on each little cube here, together with overlap arguments or LQ bounds on the counting function. So if you take a collection, say, of n tubes and let n sub q assign to each small cube the number of tubes that intersect q, then we obtain LQ bounds, little LQ bounds on the counting function that go like into the, I think, 1 minus 1 over q, delta to the minus 1 over q, and then some power of log delta. And so using the LQ counting bounds, applying to the LP estimate, no loss estimate, and the L infinity estimate, interpolating, you get the correct LP plus 2 estimate. So I won't go through that since we're getting close to the boundary of my talk. But let me just finish this with a little picture. So what does this tube decomposition refer to? Well, thinking back to the idea that your energy flow is supposed to respect the geodesic flow. So I should say every one of these tubes, sorry, every one of these terms is itself a spectral cluster, a rescaled spectral cluster. So you have a decomposition of one spectral cluster into a bunch of spectral clusters. Essentially, it's like you're decomposing the wave equation, solution to the wave equation, into tubes, which are themselves invariant under the flow, and so therefore themselves are like wave equations. So this decomposition essentially commutes to first order with your second order operator. So it has to respect the geodesic flow of your operator. And so that brings up the question, well, what is the geodesic flow for a Hamiltonian, Lipschitz Hamiltonian, and why do these tubes respect it? Well, if you're looking at a Lipschitz Hamiltonian and look at the corresponding corresponding Hamiltonian flow, this is, of course, not well posed because this is merely an L infinity function. So you can have bifurcation of geodesics. The direction can split and geodesics can split. But the fact that this is bounded tells you that the CDT, an absolute value, is less than absolute C, or put this way, the change in the angle of any geodesic is less than 1. So you can have bifurcation of geodesics, but they can only move apart at unit speed in angle. And so in particular, if they're flowing over distance delta, the angle can only, of two geodesics can only spread by, they can only end up angle delta apart, and therefore they can only end up physically distance delta squared apart. So these delta by delta squared cubes respect the Hamiltonian flow of the Lipschitz metric in the sense that if you have any geodesic that starts within the tube, it has to essentially stay within the tube. Okay. And precisely that would be captured by commutator bounds on the cutoff with your second order operator, the fact that they respect the Hamiltonian flow of your equation. Okay. And so trying to improve upon this argument, of course, we'd like to get the sharp L8 estimate, but it's going to require a more careful summation argument than this example here, some sort of worst case scenario argument on how these tubes can come together. Because, for example, we have not yet ruled out, you know, on L8, we're only keeping track of propagation over distance lambda minus 1/6. We're not, you know, continuing that into the next cube. So we need some better counting argument to improve upon.